Hi, I'm John.
And I'm Kevin.
Two creatives who have recently placed creativity at the center of our lives, and this is the Time is Right podcast.
Today, we're continuing our interview series with people who live with a creative focus, people who have made their lives richer by being creative, the not famous or not yet famous, or maybe occasionally somebody who is a little famous, but mostly people who have a creative story to tell. Today, we have with us Jeffrey Jen Edwards. Jeffrey Jen is a science fiction writer. And his first novel, Plenum, the First Book of Deo, has just been published. Dr. Edwards has a vast and diverse background, everything from astrophysics to artificial intelligence, geomantics, design and disability studies, even including performing arts. So we thought Dr. Edwards would be a good person to talk about being creative and living with a creative focus in our lives. So hello, Jeffrey Jen.
Hi there.
Welcome. Should we call you Jeffrey Jen or Doctor or...
GJ if you want to.
GJ, okay. all right, GJ, so we kind of always start off with asking people, what are their creative jams? What are you doing right now creatively in your life? Maybe professionally, it may not be. It just may be hobbies and things that you're interested in, just whatever you're up to these days.
So right now I'm working on the third novel of the 15-book science fiction saga that I've got being developed. The first book is the one that's just being published. The second book is being edited by the publisher. And I am working on the third book. That's fun because it's all down there. It's just the tweaking and the fine tuning to get it into shape to be published. So in relation to the first book that's going up, I have been developing a fashion show promotion of the book. So I have picked scenes out from the books of the science fiction scenes. I've had them turned into 3D visual graphics. I have the weaver who has made belts that can be recognized with our augmented reality camera. And so we project virtually 3D elements from the books around the person in the fashion show through visualizing their belt.
That's also cool.
A very fascinating.
That's very cool.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, you had me at 15 volumes first.
I am crazy.
My first novel was one book and I thought it was a standalone and somebody convinced me to write a second. And I'm like, that's as far as I get. very ambitious. And really, I think that's really interesting, bringing in the multimedia, trying to expand the creativity around. It's not just a book, right? There's kind of an experience that's happening with it.
Yeah. I've been doing this kind of immersive multimedia work for about 20 years as a researcher. So I'm building on the experiences as doing research in this area.
So do you recall when you first deliberately tried a creative project, something that was not just, I mean, we all very creative when we're kids. You know, we cite a study here all the time about how every person is born creative and then society and school, you know, beats us senseless.
Beats the creativity out of us, I think is how we put it.
Energies out of us, yes. So at what point did you start to think you wanted to do something that was creative just for the sake that it was creative but it was intentional?
Yeah, so I mean, as a young man, I did write fiction, but I felt that the fiction that I was writing wasn't very good. And so I eventually set that aside to take on the job as a scientist. And about mid-career as a scientist, I started to get itchy feet. I started to feel like I could be doing something else than this. And so I had always had an interest in sculpture. As a boy, I liked woodworking. So I started to develop some, it was kind of a pastime as a sculptor. I did it for about a year and a half. I developed a number of sculptures involving wire, so metal wire, fabric, and eggs. So this combination of hard things with fragile things. And so I developed a series of egg sculptures in that way.
Did you have formal training in that? Or
no, just... no training in it whatsoever. It was just stepping off the deep end. I have known artists for a long time. And one of the things that I've always admired about artists is they own their work. They take full possession of the fact that they are doing something important, and they will stand behind their work in public. And I got this thing that maybe I should do something like that. And I didn't do it with the sculpture because the sculptures I was making were very big and they filled up my house and they got very, very unmanageable. And so I eventually shifted into fabric and sewing. And then that filled up my house as well. So
I think that ties in pretty closely with what we've talked about before, which is the intentionality. You're doing something as a creator for an intentional purpose with an intentional reason. And it ties in too with also, like you said, they're standing up with their work and they're standing up for it. We have mentioned something similar as in, you know, giving yourself permission and that kind of giving that, and you mentioned it, giving it yourself permission to try it or to try something else when one thing either wasn't satisfactory or wasn't kind of giving you what you needed, I guess, from that.
Yeah. As a sculptor, I never really called myself a sculptor. But when I got into fashion design, I spent 3 years learning to sew and then started to do design. And about a year and a half into that, I thought, I'm good at this. And that's when I stood up and said, okay, I'm a designer now. And I started to do collections, launches for collections. So again, standing up behind the creation.
You know, one of the things we've talked about a lot in the past, in addition to giving yourself permission, is also that there's a certain amount of vulnerability you open yourself up to when you do that. A lot of people feel imposter syndrome. A lot of people feel, and I certainly do. And it's not so much an unwillingness to stand behind the work so much as a feelings of fear and vulnerability, being a bit afraid to get that stuff out there for fear of whatever recrimination or self-recrimination one might experience. And it sounds like, doesn't sound like something that dogged you too much or did it?
Imposter syndrome, I have it in the writing. I mean, as a novelist now, not so much for the science fiction, I think, but I am also working on a novel that is much closer to my own experience, a novel about gender fluid identity. And there I have qualms about publishing because, but it's less an imposter syndrome than it is fear of what kind of reaction it will generate.
That's probably true with most writing or actually any kind of creativity where when you're getting closer to yourself, it feels more important, but it's also more daunting because you are men putting yourself out there. I don't want to say to be judged, but people will judge you just for the fact that you put yourself out.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
It is daunting, yes. So you mentioned that you started writing science fiction, then kind of put it aside for a while and did some other things, and then you came back to the writing. Can you talk a little bit about just kind of how your creativity has evolved over the years a little bit more?
Sure. So my career as a scientist, I started off in astrophysics. My PhD was in astrophysics. But I got hired into, there were no jobs in astrophysics when I finished, because it was the year after the space shuttle blew up. And all the jobs in astronomy dried up. So I got a job as a researcher in a different field, which was geomatics, surveying, essentially. And I ended up working for a number of years in surveying. But right from the beginning, I got involved with a group that was doing research in the relationship between cognitive science and geographic science. which appeal to me. You know, this kind of eclectic ways of thinking about the world. And so the research that I did for most of my career came out of that mixture. So I started off doing image analysis and this kind of stuff in forestry and agriculture. And over time, I shifted towards more aesthetic kind of, so park design. And because that's, you know, from forestry into park design. But at the time, I was also interested in how people perceive spaces. So park spaces were interesting from that perspective. And then from there, I got involved in with people with disability and movement science and the performing arts, and started to work in research in those areas. So it was a kind of, so there's a number of things going on there. I set out to work with the best of the field. So in AI, I approached people in AI who are top of their field and I worked with them. In cognitive science, I did the same. And so when you're working with the best, you know, you learn the business from the best. And then this kind of mix and match, just switching from one field to the next each time, destabilizing myself and then reintegrating a new way of thinking. And I did that constantly. I did it 10 major shifts or so over the course of my career as a scientist. This a process of destabilizing and then reintegrating.
Yeah. And I think that that kind of touches on an interesting element of creativity. You, as a scientist, I think most people wouldn't associate that with being particularly creative, but it really, I mean, there are in any kind of profession, there are probably jobs and roles that exercise creativity less. But from what you've described, it sounds like you had a good opportunity to really kind of explore creative areas of the brain and human actions and things of that nature. Do you have any thoughts along those lines?
Those kinds of things have always fascinated me right from the get-go. So I got involved working with neurologists. I worked with top dancers and choreographers as well. Again, always following this principle of looking for the best in the field to work with. I was extremely well-funded. Now, the issue of the funding of science is tricky. And there were difficulties with what I was doing because I was always left field for everybody. I was way out in front for what most people were looking at. But if you frame it right when you're applying for funds, you can get backing. And I had backing my whole career. So I don't know how many millions of dollars I went through, but it was something close to $20 or $30 million of research funds that I had control over at various times over the course of my career. You can bring in resources to do this kind of stuff. So obviously that gave me a kind of arrogance, personal kind of arrogance. So when I got into the writing, I brought that arrogance with me, with this idea of, oh, I could do 15 books, no problem.
Yeah, I worked for a while with IBM, and I worked with some researchers in some of their deepest think tanks. And so I'm familiar with what you're talking about. And I think one of the things that many of us were accused of is being kind of arrogant. And it's, I don't know what it stems from. You know what you know, and you're aware of not knowing what you don't know. Sometimes I think that comes off as arrogant to some people, I guess. So what kind of creative failures have you experienced, and kind of what were the lessons that you took from those?
So that was a very interesting question. The first creative failure that I thought about, so after I learned to sew and did fashion design, I launched a private company to manufacture and sell clothes. The first fashion collection I did was a set of dresses that I did under that brand. But it was a very intense period of time, and I overcommitted my own personal energy resources, and I got very sick as a result of doing that. I developed a severe form of apnea, which I still struggle with today, and I had to put the whole business to one side. I was on my own, and I didn't have the means to keep it going. So that was a a real major letdown. And what I learned from that, of course, is to be much more careful about my own resources, my own body resources. Yep. You know, I mean, even as a writer, body matters, even though, you know, so I pay attention to my body resources now in a way that I didn't as much when I was a younger man.
I think we all can identify with that.
Because balancing full-time work, which is unrelated to music, and then also composing when I can, and then other things that I do, you know, you have to just give yourself permission to not do things sometimes. And that's just sort of how it is, I guess. Yeah.
Which is hard for me, as you can see. I tend to overcommit even today. I'm doing way too many things. But I do them one at a time, and I don't, you know, so I just do several threads one at a time, and they all move forward slowly. So
the voice of experience.
So you've worked on a lot of different creative projects over the years. What's been most personally important to you?
So I think the book that I'm just in the process of publishing is, for me, it's huge to publish a first novel. It's the first of the 15. I didn't actually go looking for, I planned on going looking for a publisher. And I had started to make some efforts in that direction. But I stumbled across a group who were doing online discussions and conversations that are recorded. And they had a project to develop their own publishing label under a cooperative arrangement. And so because I was involved in the cooperative, anyway, at some point they said, well, we're going to publish not only your book, but your 15 books. Now, you can't find a traditional publisher that's going to do that.
No.
So I said, yes. So I feel extremely lucky to be in a situation where we're not only is the first book going out, but I have the next ones all lined up. And it looks like they're going to happen. So that's huge. The other thing I mentioned is a few years ago, we developed an opera based on one of the books. A very short opera, 20-minute opera. But still, it was a real opera with actors, singers, and the whole kit and caboodle. And it was an amazing experience to do that. Absolutely amazing.
Did you score that yourself?
No, I worked with composers and others who did the scoring. Yeah, but I wrote the lyrics.
That leads me to a question about, and it's actually something we don't talk a lot about on the podcast. Mostly we talk about individual journeys and things like that, but it's obvious you've done a great deal of collaborative work, both in your professional work and also, and I'm fascinated by this opera being a composer. So what was that like working, you know, with your text, your libretto, your ideas from your fiction and bringing that to someone in a completely different field, a composer? And how did that go? How did that gel for you?
So those are great questions. As you point out, I've done collaborative work my whole career as a scientist. Mm-hmm. It's never been easy. With occasional individuals, it just clicks and everything rolls out. And you don't have to put it. I found a few collaborators like that. But most of the time, it's really hard work to collaborate. You don't understand each other, and you make assumptions, and then the other person runs off with the assumptions, and they come back, you know, and you have all these tensions. So the opera was more like that experience than the other, the easy one, you know, because there are a lot of people with very different ideas, people you didn't necessarily know, who came in with their own agenda. And sometimes I'm not sure I want to say on air, but there were some very nasty things that went down. And because I was manager, I had to step in and say, stop this or do this, or, you know, because that's where the position I was in. So
sure.
Collaboration is tricky. But I think that's true of what you hear about episodic television. I think that's the same kind of thing with the same kinds of problems. Yeah. So
whenever I'm doing collaborations, doesn't happen so much with you, John, but when I'm doing it with, and that's probably just because we share a brain or something, but I think whenever I'm doing them with other people, I'm always surprised at what they didn't understand from something I was saying. I try to anticipate questions that people have or concerns, and I'm never right. I must be a really terrible judge of people. I don't know. But I think, you know, to me, that's one of the big challenges is you have to become really good at listening because you have to pick up on what it is that the people didn't get from you because they don't always tell you.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Okay. And, remember our experience in the band.
Yeah. Well, again,
don't do that.
Right.
All the things we did when we were 25. Don't do those things.
Yeah. Well, that was a collaborative effort in falling apart.
As a scientist, I learned to collaborate with people across different disciplines. Mm-hmm. And there, what goes on is that people bring, when they learn a discipline, the first things they learn go into the automatic, invisible section of the knowledge. And it's just implicitly there. And so you have to get them to bring it to the surface, that knowledge, in order to be able to understand another person in a different discipline. So one learns to focus on the deep knowledge a person has and encourage them to bring that up so that when they talk to each other, they will understand each other.
I wanted to touch on the novel again a little bit, because you mentioned that as your most important personal creation to date, and understand that, you know, it's the first one, it's a big commitment for the series and so forth, but what elements in the novel are kind of making it so important to you?
Yeah, so out of the 15 novels, it's not the first one I wrote, it's the third or fourth one I wrote. It was the hardest one to write. It deals with a character who is religious, and I am myself interested in a religious perspective, but I was brought up atheist. And so putting myself into a character who has a religious understanding of the world, I found extremely difficult. But I think it's very important for the world that we do more of this. And so it's sort of a personal interest I have in the work. So this book, The Plenum, is a kind of cut at this problem of getting people to pay attention to things they don't know so well. It also deals with gender fluidity and things like that as in the novel, which is, as I mentioned, close to my own experience of the world. So it deals with, it's science fiction, but it reorganizes many of the things that are very close to my deep passions.
And it sounds like it stretched you in some a little bit out of your comfort zone.
Yes, but I'm used to that. I always destabilize myself. So
But still, even when you do that intentionally and you're familiar with the process, every time you do it, and you're inhabiting that unfamiliar space, it's daunting. It is daunting. A challenge. So what creators inspire you? People you might follow or people you've read about, people in your life?
So, I mean, there are writers who inspire me, right? In science fiction, Frank Herbert, very popular right now because of Villeneuve's work, but he's been a long, long fan. It's funny because I love Frank Herbert's writing, but I don't like write Frank Herbert at all. If I have a regret, it's that I don't write like him. I would like to write more like my models than I do. Le Guin, of course, I love her work. And Samuel Delaney is another writer who I really, really admire.
I love Delaney, yeah.
other than that, there are other people like I mentioned, producers of television series, you know, where you have to bring everything together, or even a film director or a producer. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Those are kind of people I really admire what they do. Here in town, we have a playwright who has a very big business. Robert Lepage is known throughout the world, but he has his own theater and produces his own work in his own theater.
You mentioned something interesting. It's like television series producers and things like that. And obviously, showrunners have to take a very long view of their stories, sometimes not knowing how many episodes they're going to get or how many seasons they're going to get. And I wonder if some of that thought process entered into your mind when you decide, I'm going to do a 15 novels, 15 book series.
Yes. Well, I certainly am aware of it when I write, because it's five trilogies, and each book in each trilogy acts like an episode in a series, right? Because you have a you have a character arc inside the book, then you have the character arc across the three books, and then you have the character arc across the 15 books, because they're intertwined. So I have to keep all those things feeding off each other all the time, much like episodic television. So, and you know, when I started, I had no idea whether I was going to get any of it published. So I do feel that luck of the draw somehow. Although maybe one makes one's own luck. There is that too.
There is definitely that.
So you mentioned you're working on the books and that you're still working on that series. Sounds like you've been working on it for a while. I don't know how fast you write. There's a few years work there, I think.
20 years, maybe. and I'm 65, so there are issues there as well. So,
So there's kind of a well-known thing in the writer community, and I'm sure it happens in other communities, where once you become kind of a full-time writer, or at least that's your central focus, you need a new hobby. So what else are you doing outside of writing?
So I mentioned the fashion show work that I'm doing. So I have a number of fashion projects. I kind of like sewing as a tangible thing. It's working with your hands, and I find it offsets the writing. When I was an academic, I found that I could do two out of three things. I could do fashion design and sewing and writing. The research fell by the wayside. Or I could do the academic research and the fashion, and then the writing fell by the wayside because I couldn't do it all. Now I'm retired from the academic world. In principle, I have the time to do the two, fashion design and the writing. I do have, however, another set of projects. My brother works in private industry. He owns his own company. And I adore working with my brother. And so he invited me on as a consultant with his company, and I said yes. For one day a week, I work on engineering innovation with them as an extra thing, but it brings in a little bit of revenue on top of what I get also, so it's nice for that as well.
So what do you think you're going to do next then, other than book four?
Yes, well, if it was just book four, I mean, the problem is I have several other series that I have got under development, including a historical trilogy and a thriller that I'm working on. So there are other longer term projects there as well. And I have in mind to teach myself to write screenplays, which I'm told you do by jumping in the deep end and writing one. That's the best way to learn. As a scientist, I learned that in order to work with other people in an area, if you did the work yourself in that area, you could understand enough what was going on that you could work with other people to do the stuff. And I sort of feel like if my books ever get turned towards screenplay, that kind of stuff, it would be nice if I understood the process. So I kind of feel that it would be a useful thing to know, even if I didn't write myself the screenplays. But if I understood the process, I think I could give a better grounding and guidance over the process. Mm-hmm. So that's a goal that I have. It's a big one. I've got other fish to fry in the meantime.
Yeah, I feel like I have the same problem. I've just got too many things. I'm trying to launch a pen name and write books under that, as well as things under my own name. And it just never seems to stop with creative ideas that turn into projects that I think I'm actually working on.
Yeah, so Jeffrey Jen is a pen name that I've chosen, mm-hmm. but I'm aligning my actual name. My birth name is Jeffrey Edwards, but I am aligning myself as Jeffrey Jen Edwards. The problem is there are a number of Jeffrey Edwards writers out there. They are there's a television personality who passed away not that long ago, but there's also a political scientist who writes under that name. And so I decided that it would be nice, maybe a better idea, to have a unique name.
Yeah, when I was researching my pen name, I made sure that it was not common in any field. It is something you have to consider.
I've had a heck of a time trying to find a unused band name to do music under, and so I just keep this stupid screen name I came up with like 20 years ago. But yeah, you know, that one no one ever takes, so it's
yeah.
Well, I did that trick with the titles for my books. So Plenum might have been used, but Plenum, the first book of Dale, has never been used. So these combination titles are another way to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, John Davis, not exactly an uncommon name.
Is that the guy from Korn? Or Slipknot? I can't remember. Oh, God, now I'm going to be really embarrassed. I may just cut that out.
So writing is often a solitary effort, usually, unless you have collaborators. But it usually helps if you belong to some sort of a writing community. And I know you and I met under a couple of communities, the Nebula Awards and the Writing Discord that we both belong to. Are there any other kind of communities, creator communities, that you belong to?
Yeah, well, that's how I got into trouble with the extras on writing, because I've done NaNoWriMo for a number of years, mm-hmm. which I like. Yeah, you know, it's more co-writing. It's not not critiquing, but there is a strong community here in Quebec City who writes under NaNoWriMo. And they're mostly young, which I really like. So I get to spend time around young people who are thinking through these kinds of issues, which I really enjoy. Before I did that, I did the 3-day novel contest for 5 years. So that's a Canadian run contest where you produce a novel in 3 days. It's Labor Day weekend, essentially. So it's a real exercise in discipline. Yeah. And so between four NaNoWriMos and 5 3-day novel contests, I produced 9 additional novels in addition to the 15. But they have to be finished at some time, you know? I don't know when, but... So I've stopped doing those now. But the communities are interesting. And I'm on the Twitter, and I find the writing community on Twitter is very good, actually, very interesting. In fact, I managed to find through them access to publications, places to publish, but also residences. So I've done a number of writer residences. I did one in Crete and I did one in Poland that I found through Twitter.
Right.
So very useful connections that way. And there's a Quebec Writers Federation, Anglophone. So Quebec, of course, is a French-speaking culture, but there is a strong English-speaking culture here as well. And the English writers of Quebec have their own association. So that also provides a community context that's interesting.
All right. I think it's time for our resource section.
I agree.
Every episode, we try to present some resources to help you on your creative journey. And as usual, we will ask our guest for theirs. Jeffrey Jen, did you bring a resource for us?
So I'm not very good with resources, per se. I thought hard about this. What I can offer is a kind of a principle that I follow. Okay. And I hear this a lot, sites that are promoting pedagogy or things like that. Learn at your level. So you take a class, you don't try to shoot for the moon. You just take classes that you can reach, and that way you get self-reinforcing, because every step you advance, you can manage to do reasonably well, and so you get this sort of self-reinforcing. I've never done that. I have always gone for the largest, biggest thing, you know, and I've read a number of textbooks on string theory, for instance. I'm a physicist by training, but string theory is way beyond my understanding of physics. But I read textbooks on string theory because I will understand 20% of the book, but the 20% is huge compared to what most people understand about string theory, even though I miss the larger stuff. So I've always taken this idea that do the very big things, even if you and I'd rather fail spectacularly than do reasonably well at a low level. So the business, for instance, that I failed because of my health issues, that was a spectacular failure. But I learned such a lot from doing that. And I have no regrets about having gone through the process. I understand how a company is put together. I understand how one manufactures and sells a garment. And I'm still dabbling in that area. I just don't do it quite as much as I did. So it's this idea of, I understand that there are people, I don't think it's for everybody, this idea that you take on big jobs and you expect to fail. But for me, it has been one of the most productive sources of creativity in my life.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I've always... John knows, right? I take some pretty big steps sometimes, and now I've quit jobs with no new job in mind, but came out okay. And then, you know, even with me and my writing and starting up a small publishing company, it's like, I know very little about the business, although I was in publishing and the distribution end many years ago, but set out to learn it all. And that was, same idea, right? It's always biting off a little more than you think you're comfortable with, at least, is kind of the way I approach it.
I've always lived under the principle that I can do anything because no one told me I can't. And so nobody told me I couldn't do this, so I must be able to do this. Or maybe I can't, but I'll figure that out on my own.
Well, and I think there's a bit of a reaction that I have too, is often if somebody tells me I can't, it makes me want to do it more.
Well, yeah, there's that, yeah.
There is that too.
I'm going to do it despite what you said. Even if I fail spectacularly, I'm still going to do it.
What do you got, Kevin?
Oh, you're going to go to me. Okay. I came across this, it's a website, and I'm not 100% sure there's a lot of uses for it, but I just think it's really interesting to see what, and this may interest you a little bit too, Jeffrey Jennings, that it's a collaboration between humans and AI to create art. And the website is called artreader.com. And you can take an image. A lot of people take a portrait of their pets or something. You can take what's already been created there, or you can upload your own pictures. And then you can work with the AI to change it and enhance it. And it's really fascinating. And I came across it through a podcast by Elle Penelope. She's a fantasy author, and she's using it right now to create promotional materials for her characters. So she's running a series called Meet the Characters, and these characters are all these AI generated
they're not really photographs, but they're like little snapshots of these characters from her books, and she's able to manipulate them. And I just thought that was really fascinating. So that's artbreeder.com.
I think people are using that to make cover art as well for books. I've heard of it being used that way. So
yeah, it can be any kind of image.
I could talk a little bit about, so I work with this site called infiniteconversations.com, which is conversations about all sorts of topics. But we also publish, so we're publishing my series of books, but it's a cooperative, and it will be interested in publishing other books as well. So I think it's of interest to writers and creators.
John, what do you have for us?
I didn't bring a thing or a site or anything in particular. I brought a something everyone should do. And that is a to-do list. Yes. No, bring a pen. Always have a towel. No. The thing that one of the most valuable things I've found lately is the voice recorder on my phone. And I started playing more around with this for field recording, because I never had a easy way to capture sound out in the world. And then I've since, gotten better equipment. But there's really nothing more valuable than recording your thoughts as they happen. When you have an idea, I find it sometimes easier to talk it out than it is to write it down. And that's not true for everybody, but as things come to you, just dictating to yourself is pretty useful. And every phone has one of these things. It's super easy to use. And most people, a lot of people probably just don't even think to use it. But I know you do, Kevin. I know you do that stuff all the time. But I only just started using it for that kind of thing, mostly because I wanted to always have something with me to record sounds I hear, because I use found sounds and field recordings and some of my music as well. And it's now it's got me like, I should just, rather than try to write this idea down, express it. It's especially useful for musicians too, because you can hum, you can make noises and things like that into it as well. But I think for any creative, just getting those ideas out of your head as quickly as possible at the speed of thought is valuable. So that's my thing. Recorders.
Yeah, I take a lot of voice notes when I'm exercising. So it's easier than typing.
Yeah, prosaic, but there it is.
It's hard to jog and type at the same time, but I can speak.
Well, you need to challenge yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've tried it, but I don't seem to quite get my head around it yet. But I haven't given up.
General dictation for composing, I can't do. I just can't do that. I don't listen to audiobooks either, because for some reason I just don't enjoy the experience. But that's just me.
And, yeah, I'm not a fan. But my brother-in-law loves them. He lives on audiobooks constantly. He's got them going all the time.
So. I listen to them as I read. So
interesting.
I like the two together, listening to it and reading at the same time.
But you're reading the same book you're listening
to,
right?
Yeah, the same book. Yeah.
Well, you're kind of an overachiever. I just wanted to make sure.
But for instance, I've been listening to Proust in French. And so I tend to fall asleep with Proust if I just listen, and even if I just read. But the two of them together keeps me awake. So
that's interesting. All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us and talking with us here. This has been great. Love hearing all these different perspectives that people bring, and glad to have you here.
My pleasure.
Let us know where people can find more about you.
So I'm at www.jeffreyjenedwards.com. It's probably got too much material on there. I'm going to have to simplify it soon. But because it's got my scientific publications on there, and as well as all the, so hundreds of scientific. I mean, they're not all accessible, but they're listed.
And you mentioned you're on Twitter?
I am. I'm G.Dot Moda, which is one of my, which is the first company I created for doing clothing. So I'm still on, I still use that as a handle on Twitter.
And John?
And I'm John Davis. I am a composer and musician. I compose under the name JD Sampo, and you can find my work at Bandcamp at jdsampo.bandcamp.com, or you can find me on SoundCloud as JD Sampo. You can also find me on Instagram and Twitter at JD Sampo, also on YouTube. In fact, on YouTube, you will find my music and video stuff combined together, and that's where some of the cooler stuff resides. Just search for JD Sampo, and that's where you'll find me. And Kevin?
And I'm Kevin J. Fellows, and you can find me at kevinjfellows.com and also on Twitter and Instagram as at Kevin J. Fellows.
Excellent. Okay. Well, I think that's our show. Jeffrey Jen, thank you again very much for joining us. I really appreciate you spending some time with us and sharing your thoughts and experiences. And it's been a lot of fun. Really appreciate it. Folks, if you enjoy the show, we would appreciate if you could leave us a review or at least give us a few stars. Helps us build up in the search results. Share it with your friends. And thank you for spending another hour with the Time is Right podcast. That's the end of our show. So
long for now.
Bye for now.
I don't know. You know why? Because someone else that I've been watching on YouTube is using so long for now as their sign off. And it infected my brain.
I thought you were just screwing with me.
No. All right, toss it.
I'm
to
leaving
you.
This in. I'm leaving this in. It's too funny.
Oh, okay.
Anyway.
All right. So, like, bye for now.
Bye for now.
Bye bye.